And a number of folks whose paths have crossed with mine over the course of these years. I think this is my seventh visit to summer teaching at Holden. I remember it started in 1984, and so a few years have passed, but it's good to be back. And the topic has been chosen, obviously, here, because we're on the far side of Holden's experience of a natural disaster, and how might we understand God, the biblical material, and natural disasters. That's the theme. And I've got five topics, basically. Let me just list for the 5 days how we speak of God's relationship with the world today. Tomorrow, how will we speak of God in creation, particularly in Genesis 1 and 2. Wednesday, the book of Job and its reflections on God and natural disasters. Natural disasters is an issue that the book of Job is centered upon. Most of Job's suffering comes from natural disasters. And we'll need to focus on that. And then on Thursday, what shall we say about issues of suffering? Kind of broaden that conversation. And then finally Friday, God in the shape of the future, and a few other God topics that will no doubt weave their way into our conversation as we move along. It's not enough to say that you believe in God. What matters is the kind of God in whom you believe. And all kinds of people believe in God. And those beliefs vary as you make your way across various religions and various communities. And my particular concern is a biblical view of God, particularly Old Testament perspective. And what might we do with that understanding of God as it relates to natural disasters? My main concern is, underneath all of this, is the mission of the church. A major reason, I think, for the diminishing effect of the church in our society today is the understanding of God and a relationship to issues of suffering and disaster. What kind of God does the church present in its preaching and its teaching and its worship? We often have an understanding of God whose will always gets done in the world. So away we go, and we'll be moving away from that a little bit, I hope, along the way. We so often live with a kind of flick of the wrist kind of God, a snap of the finger kind of God. Our God need only snap the divine fingers to stop things from happening or to change a situation from bad to good. And in the wake of a personal tragedy or a family heartbreak or community disaster, this image of God sets many a person into a theological tailspin and away from the church they drift over the course of years, if not all of a sudden. It's a major issue with which we must contend. Where is God in all of these issues of disaster and tragedy? Out and about in the church, there's a lot, or out and about in the society, let alone the church, there's a lot of what we might call church-caused scar tissue. Or theology-caused scar tissue. I think that the experiences of disaster and other traumatic experiences in life and the way we think about God in relationship to those experiences is one of the greatest barriers to the mission of the church in our time. think it's drawing people away, pushing people away. I don't want anything to do with that kind of God. It doesn't make sense. So I would like to suggest that thinking together about the kind of God with whom we are in relationship, particularly today, may be of help in such times. And question, what happens to our understanding of God if we take the word relationship seriously? And I've got a handout here that I'd like to begin that conversation with, if you pass these around. My question is, what happens to our understanding of God if we take the word relationship seriously? And on one side of the sheet that's coming around, there's one for tomorrow on creation, which is entitled, God Created the World Good But Not Perfect. That's a very important conversation when thinking about natural disasters. God created the world good, but not perfect. And then that we'll get to tomorrow. But turn initially to the entitled page, Understanding the God-Human Relationship, a Biblical Perspective. And I'm just going to read these, and then I'm going to come back and reflect on some of them a little bit more, and we'll pick up a couple of others on this list as we move through the week, toward the latter of the week in particular. Just take a look at these. Everyone got something here? Okay. One, just get the list here. God so enters into relationships that God will remain absolutely faithful to commitments made. Or in other words, God is not free. Number two, God so enters into relationships that God is concerned about our entire selves, including our spiritual lives and our bodily lives. Not just simply a matter of spiritual issues. Three, God so enters into relationships that God is genuinely affected by what happens in the relationship. The affectability of God, the key issue. Fourth, God so enters into relationships that God will be present with us through thick and thin. The presence of God is a key issue. Next, God so enters into relationships that God's will is not the only will that can be effective. In other words, it's not only God's will that gets done in this world. Your will, my will, and other people's will sometimes gets done, and it stands against the will of God. Six, God so enters into relationships that God is not the only one who has something important to say. Can you imagine a relationship of consequence, a serious relationship, in which only one member of the relationship had anything important to say? I think it's sometimes the way in which we treat God and the community of faith. God's the only one who has something important to say here, folks. On to the next question. Well, seven. God so enters into relationships that God is not the only one who has something important to do, and the power with which to do it. God's not the only one in this relationship with power. You and I have power too. Number eight, God so enters into relationships that the future is not all mapped out. There are uncertainties related to that shape of the future, and what you and I do helps give shape to that future. And then I'm working on this list. I got wrote down a number nine here. And I'm working on number 10. So over the course of these days together, let's see if we can come up with a 10. Number nine is God so enters into relationships that God understands the need for a healthy space in the relationship. Okay, so we're going to try to unpack some of these as we move along, and we'll do a few of them today. Think of the best relationships that you have. Picture maybe one person with whom you're close. Bring it into your head. A spouse, a friend, a child. Okay? Get that person there. Yeah. Hold on to that image and live with it as we move through these matters together. What do you mean by relationship? What makes a relationship genuine? What makes it good? If only one of you had something important to say, what kind of relationship would that be? If only one of you had power, what kind of relationship would that be? Now, such relational interests these days are driven by the increased recognition of the connectedness of our life together. It's evident in such varied matters as, just think of the impact of 9/11, how that, just ripples that just extended all through our dimensions of our life together. Or the environmental crisis, economic crises, even the use of the internet, connected. We live in I like the image of a spider web of a world. And developments across the globe at various levels, both positive and negative, have sent that web a-shaking in our own time. And a key question becomes, how should that increasingly intense relational reality, connectedness of our life together, shape our language about God and its implications for the life of the church? I think if we were more deliberate in our talk about a God in relationship and think carefully together about what relationship, a genuine relationship, entails, God talk might become more important for people. And they might stay closer to the life of the church than they commonly do. One of my basic questions then, in view of this list that we've just glanced through, is when we use the language of relationship for God, what do we mean by relationship? What constitutes a genuine relationship? Presumably the only kind of relationship that God can have, right? Now, one of the ways to get inside this is we can explore various metaphors for God that we use in our worship, in our praying, conversation. Look at the Bible. I don't think there's any question, but the bulk of metaphors, images used for God in the Bible are highly relational. They're drawn from spheres of the human personality. For example, God speaks, God acts, God thinks, God feels, God wills. Or these images for God are drawn from the personal activity of human beings. All over the Bible, God's mouth, God's hand, God's arm. Or images from the family, husband, wife, parent, child. Some of the most intimate relationships that in which we live, those images are used to speak of God. It's both father and mother. In both Testaments, the Old Testament has more maternal images for God than the New Testament does. Okay, and then there are images drawn from the socio-political world. God is a king. We can comment on that in a little bit. God is a judge. God is a friend. God as a friend is a particularly striking metaphor, biblical metaphor for God in view of our Facebook culture. I'm struck by Jesus' statement in John 15:15. It's really striking, his language to the disciples. He echoes Isaiah 41 in this passage. Jesus says to his disciples, "I do not call you servants any longer, but I have called you friends." Friends. What difference might it make in people's understanding of God if we more regularly used the image of friend for God? Or talked about God in such a way that people could say, "Yes, God is my friend." A longtime favorite hymn of the church, of course, has been, "What a friend we have in Jesus." But all too often, at least in my pietistic experience, I'm the son of a pastor, and my father was a son of a pastor, I mean, pretty deep within us. People use the word friend for Jesus, but not for God. And still remarkably common is the understanding that Jesus came to save us from the wrath of God. Jesus is not an exception in the life of God. Jesus is not an exception in the life of God. Jesus truly reveals who God is. Here's this human being walking down the streets of Jerusalem. These images for God, then, are ordinary, they're common, they're down to earth. In fact, most of the language for God in the Bible is secular. Just go back over that list. They're secular. They're not particularly religious or heavenly or dramatic. Just kind of everyday common language for interhuman relationships is the kind of language that is used in the biblical material to speak of God. Maybe just a footnote here. Because of the metaphors that we use for God are drawn from life as it is actually lived, means that the various images for God do not have equal staying power. Take the image of God as king. And it's remarkable how relatively infrequent the kingship language for God is in the Bible. It's there. But most people haven't experienced a king or a queen, for that matter. Queen Elizabeth, maybe that'll work. We should be prepared to introduce new images for God into our conversation in view of our changing experience. And maybe other images, such as king, could be set more on the back burner a little bit, huh? Because people don't use that kind of language in their everyday experience. In our understanding of God, we take the word relationship seriously. And that this relationship is a relationship of integrity. It's genuine. And I come back now to the list that I've handed out to you. Let's look at the first one. God so enters into relationships that God will remain absolutely faithful to commitments made. Sometimes we think that God is absolutely free. Can do anything at any time, in any place, for any reason. I plead with you, don't go there. So in the midst of a tragedy or a disaster, God's free to do anything. But to think, you got that person with whom you're in relationship in your mind, okay? To think of God in this fashion will cast doubt on God's promises. Is God free to break God's promises? If so, is God really faithful to relationships that God has made? What do we say about God if we so lift up God's freedom that it trumps God's promises? To speak of God's promises to Noah, to Abraham, to David, is to speak of a God who places limits on God's action. We need to take more seriously divine self-limitation. Divine self-limitation in view of the commitments, the promises that God has made to each of us. God will be faithful to God's promises. That's a limitation, a self-limitation. To speak of the freedom of God, as sometimes happens, just because God is absolutely free, has ethical implications. I mean, if God is absolutely free, if God is radically free, then we who are God's followers should seek to be radically free too in our relationships, huh? That we can sit loose to our commitments and get on with our unfettered lives. I mean, we're going to act like God. God so enters into relationship that God will remain absolutely faithful to commitments made, and that means self-limitation with regard to freedom. God is not absolutely free on God's own choice. Yes, please.
Could we go back to your human image?
Yeah.
Would we say, for example, that your friend or spouse, if disaster happened, would be free to go do their own thing, but they would never do it because of that relationship? They would stand by you.
Yeah, and yeah, that would be the direction, I think, we've reflected. And God will stand by such commitment to relationship in a way that we never can. Okay? We understand that that's what would be entailed in a genuine relationship, but God will be faithful in a way that we never have been or will be. Yeah. Yes, please.
How does the idea of, we're so often told that God makes covenants with people. I'll do this if you do that. If you don't do that, then I have freedom to leave you.
Yeah, well, be careful of the language of covenant. The covenant language, that's another lecture, but I mean, covenant language is, there are at least two major understandings of covenant in the Bible, and make sure that we're working with one and not the other when we bring up the conversation. And covenant can be an agreement, not unlike a marriage relationship. That can be a covenant. Or covenant can be a personal commitment. Not an agreement, except a self-agreement, where God is committed to a certain understanding and understanding of relationship. And so the covenants with Noah, there's no if, then there. God makes a promise. End of conversation. That's a promise. You can count on it. Come what may. Abraham, that's a promise. It doesn't depend upon how you respond. It's a promise. David, it's a promise. It doesn't depend on how you respond. There's no if, then. I promise. And so, whether you're, but on the other hand, in certain biblical texts, covenant can be an agreement between two parties. And so God can enter into an agreement with somebody else, and that can be covenantal understanding of things. So be careful there. That language can get tricky. Yes, please.
I was just going to say, your covenants shouldn't, you're not going to make them transactional, which is, I think, where he was going.
Yeah.
So you don't want to have this is not a transactional.
Right. The primary meaning of a covenant with God as subject is promise. Yeah, and not transaction, not agreement. So, okay, we won't forget that, but those are good questions and good conversation there. Let's go to number 2 on the list and lift up a few things there and again open it for conversation. God so enters into relationships that God is concerned about our entire selves, not only our spiritual lives, but our bodily lives as well. This concern of God for the whole self, okay, in your totality, this concern of God is true both now and in the life to come. Take the language of God's saving work in the world. How do you work with the language of salvation here? You know, the biblical language of salvation has often been narrowly conceived in the life of the church as spiritual. It's a spiritual matter. God's most fundamental activity in the life of the world has to do with sin and guilt. And only secondarily is God concerned about suffering and disease and disaster. But the Bible wants to claim, and I'll just lift up a couple of texts. The Bible wants to claim that God's saving work in the world has to do not only with deliverance from sin, that's where we go almost all the time, but it also has to do with deliverance from sin's effects. And it also has to do with deliverance from the effects of the way in which the world works, which includes natural disasters. And God's deliverance in that context, then, is the language of salvation. Think of two pillars around which the Old Testament is gathered. You get the Exodus from Egypt, and then you get the exile to Babylon. And the release from Babylon. And in the first, think about the Exodus. Deliverance from the land of Egypt. Israel's suffering occurs because of the sins of others. The Egyptians. Okay? In the exile, Israel's suffering occurs because of its own sins. I mean, in the Exodus text, just read the 15 chapters of Exodus. At the end of the 15th chapter, after all the deliverance from Egypt has taken place, what's the language that's used for the deliverance of the people from Egypt is the word salvation. Look at Exodus 15:2, for example. And to draw in the New Testament for a moment here, this broader understanding of salvation is caught up in Jesus' own ministry, where Jesus heals bodies, and not just spirits. The ministry of God, the language of salvation used with Jesus has to do not simply with the forgiveness of sins. How often we collapse salvation and forgiveness of sins? No, it also has to do with, say, the ministry of healing. Just the language of Jesus. Your faith has saved you. Go in peace. And the church sometimes might give the impression that God is concerned only about taking care of sins. Not really concerned about suffering. Too common. That if the work of God in Old Testament and in Jesus' ministry is any guide, we ought to have a comparable concern for the God's relationship to the suffering that life will bring our way. Listen to Patrick Miller, Old Testament professor. He's got a little book entitled The Interpretation of the Psalms. And it's a very fine book. Quote, Jesus Christ lived and died not only for human sin, but also for human hurt. For human hurt. And that catches us all up quickly. In other words, Jesus lived and died for everything that's you. Everything that's you. Not just your sins. We should remember the understanding of salvation in the life to come. We confess, the salvation, or the resurrection of the body every Sunday morning. In other words, salvation in the new heaven and the new earth is going to be a full-bodied salvation. The best Cabernet Sauvignon possible. Okay? And God doesn't become concerned about the body only after death. God's saving work in the world has to do with everything that's you. Everything that's you. Not only in the new world, but this world too. And so Jesus goes about healing people from their diseases, from problems that they face in life, and not simply about their sins. So let me come back to the initial statement on that, that God so enters into relationship that God is concerned about our entire selves, not only our spiritual lives, but our bodily lives as well. Questions, comments, anything you want to lift up here? Please.
All right, I work as a chaplain. And I can hear people say, then why isn't mom getting healed?
Why?
Why isn't mom getting healed?
Yeah.
Why is God concerned about the person in the next bed, but not this bed? I mean,
Let me ask you this. Is the assumption of your question, or the question of the people with whom you happen to deal with, is that God can get anything done that God wills?
Exactly.
That's the question. And too many people think that God can do anything that God wills to do. And in a given situation, it may be that God wills that somebody be healed, but that God is not successful. Because God's will is not the only will that gets done in this world. Yes, please.
I've always perceived it as an issue of God always heals, but he may not be able to cure it.
Yeah. Well, we need to work on that. Is that an ambiguous language so that people understand heal and cure in ways that are so fine-tuned? I think we tend to move. It may be that God is unsuccessful with regard to healing of, as well as curing, if you might say. Yes, please.
Could you comment on the kind of the popular theology that this Christian on everything happens for a reason?
Yeah, let's see. I've got it on the next page, but let me do it right. it's right here. The quote I had is, God won't give you any more than you can handle. Yeah. And God may not give you any more than you can handle, but the Hitlers of this world may well give you more than you can handle. It's oftentimes the assumption is that God's will always gets done, that God's will, and God's will can be significantly resisted. So that a lot of stuff that happens is not God's will, even if it happens in church. Let me go to one more here, and then we go to the thing.
As you were talking, I was thinking of Paul's comment that
Yeah.
Glorious liberty is the jewel of God.
Yeah. God's salvation there in that Romans 8 passage catches up salvation not simply for people, but catches up salvation. There's an experience of salvation on the part of all creatures, including the non-human. Yeah. Let's go to number three. God's soul enters into relationships that God is genuinely affected by what happens to the relationship. It could be a long discussion, but what kind of relationship with God would this be if God was never affected by what happened? Oh, it's sort of God, sort of oblivious, just kind of. Old Testament texts in particular are very good, and they, in fact, I think, abound with statements about God being affected by what happens to relationships. Huh? God is provoked to anger. I'll come back to that in just a minute. But there are over 500 references in the Old Testament and New Testament to God being angry. Thank goodness God gets angry. We may not enjoy it, but it's... Or God is laments over the suffering of people. Lamenting God. Jeremiah, in particular, the book of Lamentations. Or God is delighted over developments in our lives. The language of God being the subject of delight over 100 times in the Old Testament. And we don't lift up though that God being just delighted. All of a sudden it just, I have to read this one text in Zephaniah 3. The Lord, Zephaniah 3:17, the Lord your God is in your midst, the warrior who gives victory. He will rejoice over you with gladness. He will renew you in his love. He will exalt over you with loud singing. I love that. As on a day of festival. I mean, those kind of texts tend to be ignored in the life of the church. God will be affected by prayers prayed. Exodus 32, Moses prays, God changes God's mind. Interesting, God's changing God's mind, it occurs, 39 times in the Old Testament. Either God actually changes God's mind, or God potentially changes God's mind, or... It's a complicated theme, but it's remarkable in its frequency, and insufficient attention, I think, is given there. Let's look at number four.
Jerry,
yes, please.
I want to believe that careful attention to this will bring people to heaven. But I think this is the right time to say this.
Yeah.
My concern is with the limit of our affect, which is to say I encounter a lot of people who do not want to hear about pain. They do not want to feel pain. They've got all kinds of ways to avoid pain. And so suddenly God's affect forces us to be affected by our own lives and to feel it, to lament with God. And I really do think a lot of people are repelled from that kind of honesty in church.
Huh. And why do you think that's so? Is it...
Well, it hurts.
That God so feels?
And that we feel with, I mean, if you're in the presence of somebody who is hurting, you're probably affected too, that we feel the pain too.
Yeah.
But I mean, just so shut down in terms of pain. There's some people already that dizziness is an analgesic. I think I am pretty honest about God's affect. And, a lot of people think there are other things that are more fun, more positive, more uplifting.
It may be that there. God is affected, but at the same time, as we'll see, God, in being affected, is committed to the promises that have been made.
Yeah.
And so you, God's not going to be affected in such a way that God, oh, I guess I'll take back those promises. One, well, you know.
But I mean, to use some of your prior examples, what kind of friendship would it be if the friend feels your pain but you won't?
Yeah.
I mean, what a friend can offer you is really, you know, there are other wills at work here.
Yes, indeed. For sure. It's good. Bring it. Yes, please.
The cultural understanding, though, I think that God is power. And so I think some of the pain, at least that I hear, is either a resignation to God's impotency, more than, I think, the struggle with God. Can God really do what God promises to do? When I hear that struggle all the time, and that impacts my affect a great deal, in terms of trying to how to walk through that with people.
Yeah. Well, I think that there are various angles of vision, I think, that will continue to come up here too. But to press home the idea that God can actually be affected by what happens to this relationship is a matter of no small